Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to the Ask Tall Paul Radio Show. This is Tall Paul, and I'm joined with Joey D'Elia, and today is the Independence Day permacultural style show. Joey, how are you?
I'm doing well on this great Independence Day, looking to fostering a little permacultural independence.
Wonderful. I mean, it's such a beautiful day where I am. How about where you are?
Well, since I'm about, 100 feet away from you, it's looking kind of just, well, you know what? My view might be a little bit nicer than yours right now.
That's true. Yeah. Well, in case people don't know, I've been planning since about last October to move to Tipawana Farm, which is Joey's permaculture demonstration site in San Marcos, California. And I have a trailer, and it's been here, and it's been a long time coming. There was an internet situation, which was a little difficult. And so just this week, finally, I had the Verizon's Home Fusion installed, a little commercial there. And it's ultra fast internet, faster than cable at home. And I mean, I didn't plan on talking about this, but really it has allowed me to have the independence to actually leave my home in the city and to go and live out basically in the country, but right next to the city. We're literally just, a couple blocks away from the nearest main road, and there's all the major attractions you would ever need just within less than a mile away. So that, for me, I'm very grateful on this wonderful day. And Joey's helped to make it possible by inviting me to come. And, literally from where I'm sitting, I can see the fruit tree forest, which we're building. And I don't think we've talked about the food forest yet.
We haven't talked about, but that a lot of the things that are on, things that are on our little farm here that we're growing. But I guess that's a fitting. I didn't exactly think what we were going to talk about in specifics. I just know that feel that permaculture creates independence, mm-hmm. and so that's a good idea to talk about the food forest and the one that you're seeing from your view. I see it from here. And what kind of independence we can look forward to from that permaculturally designed system.
All right. So yeah. What when you're talking about this independence, what exactly are you think permaculture can offer people?
Well, I think when you design a system. With a permaculture science kind of mindset, your growing areas where you're going to grow your fruit trees or your veggie garden or these types of things, the permaculture aspect has to offer you a method a method of design, so that you can design the systems to work in like a symbiotic kind of relationship, or to work in partnership with each other, your trees and your plants and your shrubs and your vegetables and your trees and your fruit-bearing trees and your non-fruit-bearing trees. They all can work in concert to create a sustainable, very strong system. And when you create those strong, healthy systems by design, we're designing these with this practice of permaculture. When you design those systems and you implement them, they replicate what goes on in the forest. And when I think about independence, I think about all the natural things that go on out around in those forest systems, those landscapes of the deserts or chaparral landscapes or tropical landscapes, those forest systems, those plant systems, they do their thing by themselves. We don't work on them at all. But they're independent of us. And they function very nicely and very well. We can look at those and start to mimic those systems and create that independence, create our own forest systems by design with a lot more fruit-bearing kind of plants and trees in them so that the harvest from them is predominantly fruit, food for us to eat. So on top of a system kind of growing together and like a forest does that we see out in the wild and taking each part taking care of itself and its role in that forest system, we do that, but we put in specific species, and then permaculture serves to offer us that potential independence that those natural forest systems offer everything. And this system, we would design this fruit tree forest type of system, a food forest, would innately become rather independent and just dependent on us to come pick the fruit in the end times, meaning that after the startup is done and the work is put in and the different species are put in and understanding how to harvest the water and the way the different things go on with the sun and the wind and the moon and your temperatures.
Right. Now, so for the average person who's new to permaculture, they've heard about it. You know, usually when people are, you talk about a design methodology or design science, when they're designing their garden, they're really thinking, oh, I'd like a flowering plant there, and I'd like a shrub over there. And they're kind of looking at aesthetics. And I think when we're designing the food culture, the food forest and these systems, that you do not have to sacrifice the beauty for, you know, the things that you're talking about. And I know in your own food forest here, my goodness, right now there's beautiful what are called butterfly bushes. We have purple and white, and there's different yellow flowering cassias and all kinds of beautiful, beautiful trees which contribute to this. They're not all fruit trees, but in this design system, you can retain the beauty. And actually, you have more of it because you're mimicking nature as the way it was meant to be. So why don't you talk more about, like, for the average person, next time they go to their favorite nursery, what should they think about?
Oh, yeah. When you go to your nursery, like Paul was saying, when here at our farm, my field of work is arboriculture. So I work on different landscapes and take care of the trees and look after their care and their health and their aesthetical appearance, how they're pruned and how they work within these designed landscapes that are purely for looking at. And part what's happened because I've worked so much in that industry with those trees like that, I've wanted to design the systems here to incorporate that also. Like Paul was saying, there's pretty things, nice, beautiful flowering plants to look at. And what I've been trying to work on is putting those plants into these forest systems, these food systems that are found at the nurseries that are beautiful flowering plants, kind of specimen plants, and look real nice in the gardens, but also are serving different functions. So Paul mentioned the butterfly bush, and there's many different colors. They totally do attract butterflies and hummingbirds. They're very tough plants, can handle a lot of cold, and they can handle a lot of heat. They're totally available in all the different nurseries, and you could probably find special nurseries with more variety of different colors and the different leaf kind of colors too. But they can serve great function in your forest systems on top of attracting beneficial like insects and different things like that, and birds and butterflies, they can also produce a lot of leaf matter that falls on the ground. And they incorporate good into the garden in that way, or into your forest system, because they can be cut back pretty heavily, which is another aspect of what I look for in our little forest systems, that the plants aren't ultra sensitive, because that takes a lot more care, and you can't, the system can't become as independent as potentially would like it to be, because the plants need more care. So we favor these plants that can be maybe, let's say it, a little more abused, can be cut back, and they'll just, and they grow right back. There's a lot of different acacia species that when you go to your local nursery are totally available, because they're landscape plants, but we can use them in these a multifunction way. They're beautiful, beautiful flowers. They grow really fast. Once again, they can be cut heavily. They can be formed into different kind of shapes. So there's it's just a very deep subject when we start talking about what they do and where we're going with where we place them in the forest. But if we just stick with some of those acacia species, those butterfly bushes, there's a whole host of cassias, trees and shrubs that are available in nurseries that are gorgeous. Lots of times you can find them, you'll see them if once you start to learn about them in your parking lots, you know, at your local stores and things, because they're tough plants and they handle those situations well. Well, and they, in your garden situations, they look gorgeous. Those cassia trees, I think a golden medallion is a pretty common one.
What about water? Are they pretty drought tolerant?
They're all very drought tolerant, but they also can handle the land, a landscaped environment, which tends to be overwatered, which is something you're looking for. The ideal plant handles both.
Yeah.
It can go through a range. And those are the ones they sell at the, when we're at the nursery, we can find those.
Right. Now, so basically, you know, if you look in your own area, you will find trees, like the big shopping marts, you know, they're putting in trees that are easy to grow because they don't want to put a lot of care and effort into them. But so when we first started talking, I said that, you know, the one function that people are probably looking for is a beautiful aesthetic element to the garden. Well, in permaculture, we look at each item within the system and we say, well, can it serve multiple functions? So not only now are these butterfly bushes, the acacias and the cassias, these other types of trees serving that beautiful, you know, the beauty function, what other purposes do they have within the food forest?
Oh.
Come on, don't hold out on it.
Oh, okay. Well, besides beauty, a lot of these plants, the cassias, the acacias, these pea and bean family plants, Tipuana tipus especially, locusts, honey locusts, carob trees, they form a relationship with a bacteria that's ideally, hopefully, in your soil that's relative to the tree or plant that you're planting. And they infect the root and live on the root, and the root doesn't mind. It says, oh, that's okay, that's okay. You can live here, but we got to make a deal. And that deal is if that bacteria will take the nitrogen that comes from the air, and it goes into the soil, and that bacteria grabs that atmospheric nitrogen and then does a process called fixing. It changes the atmospheric nitrogen to an ammoniacal form of nitrogen that the plant can use to grow. So the plant says, okay, bacteria, I'll give you starches, carbohydrates, in exchange for that nitrogen. And then they have a what's called a symbiotic relationship. And we look for those plants to plant in our gardens, in our food forests mainly. In the gardens we do something too, but it's a little different, but can be the same almost. In the forest systems, we look to plant those plants in there because when they're forming that relationship with the bacteria and they're fixing that nitrogen's being fixed in the soil, the plant's using some of it, is a lot of it's stored in the roots in these nodules where the bacteria lives. When you go in there and you prune those nitrogen-fixing trees and bushes and little shrubs and trees, I think said that, but some of that nitrogen gets released from the root system because when you cut the top of the bushes or you cut the branches off, some of the roots die because there's the support system's gone for those root systems. The leaves are gone. So some of those roots die, and when those roots die, there's nodules of little bits of nitrogen in there, and it gets released into the soil. Now it's free for other plants to use.
And one more thing, it's free as in it doesn't cost you anything other than your original purchase, as opposed to the people who are going over and over again to your nurseries and your stores to buy fertilizer for, you know, when you're using these chemical fertilizers, you're actually harming the soil over the long haul. And this is a free way to actually get that nitrogen that you've been purchasing all along, right?
It's so right, and that's what brings us back to that
topic
of independence.
Independence. You don't have to go to the store anymore.
You start to develop patterns and different ways of designing and planting and putting in different aesthetical features, as in plants and trees, that do multiple functions. And you get these multiple functions going, you start to create fertility. And once you start creating fertility, you start creating an independent system. That's what the forest does. The forest creates its own fertilizer by dropping tons of leaves. And there's different plants that do different things in these forests. The same thing when you pick a plant that fixes nitrogen, let's say, because now that's the macronutrient for plants that in any landscape, it's what they put the most down of, is nitrogen to get the plants to grow. When you get that for free from the air, which is just so full of nitrogen, it's what the air is made of mostly is nitrogen. You get that system going where and fixing that nitrogen into the soil through that bacterial relationship with the root in the roots. We're talking about pounds of nitrogen. We're talking about a lot. This isn't a little fun and games here. This is serious business when you start putting that much nitrogen in the soil by design. You're designing the independence into the system. And those trees just happen, also those trees and plants and shrubs that are nitrogen fixing, just also happen to drop a lot of leaves. And they drop a lot of leaves and a lot of seed, which seeds are full of nitrogen and proteins and things. They break down in the soil and they break down on the top of the soil and the leaves cover the soil. Now you're creating like a little biosphere on the soil. And mind you, these plants that you're planting, these hardy nitrogen-fixing plants that you can find in your nurseries, can grow in kind of not very nice situations. And then they change the soil. They help bring the fertility up in the soil by dropping all those leaves and all those seeds, fixing that nitrogen, having the ability to be cut, like I was talking about in the beginning. They can be cut and pruned or heavily if you choose to, and that mulch can be put right, that cuttings can be put right on the ground if that's a look that you want to kind of have going.
Can we talk about that a little bit? I mean, because the average person has been trained. They've really been sold on this method that we pay someone to come in and cut the grass, keep the grass green. Everything needs to be nice and tidy, and they actually capture all those leaves, and they drive them off using a truck and putting them in a landfill somewhere. Now, some of your local municipalities have been trying to figure out, wow, this is costing us a lot of money because all of our landfills are filling up, so they're starting these composting facilities, and they're actually doing some good to do that. But if we could just ask people to maybe start thinking in a new way, to be have an independent type of thinking, and say, why do they keep talking about these forest systems, and what, how does that pertain to me? I don't live in the forest. I live in the city. Well, even you in the city, you can create systems like this and still maintain beauty, so your neighbors will not even know that you're doing something called permaculture, and because you'll have the beauty of it, plus you'll be able to keep those, mimic the forest, the leaves will fall in place, you can leave those there, or if you have to, you can compost it, like, you know, which is another topic. But there's another topic that's kind of interesting, which is weeds, because that's another thing that nobody wants, right? No, that's a trick question. Are weeds good or are they bad? So this last weekend, Joey and I went with a whole group of people, and we had a weed fest. We went to a nice lady's house.
Not that kind of weed fest.
No. There was a weed walk where we went around this woman's property. She had about 2 acres or so, and we had an expert who showed us all the edible weeds in the garden and also the medicinal weeds. So for thousands and millions of years, the humans on the planet and even the animals use natural weeds in the environment for their medicine, for food, but somehow we've been taken away and separated from our natural instincts to know what is good and healthy for us, and we only buy things at grocery stores. All right. So, Joey, when we were walking around, we tasted some things. So there was some pretty delicious food out there. What do you think?
No, there was definitely some nice things to eat. Some were a little bitter, which is what happens. Those things are bitter. A lot of them get hybridized and bred to be less bitter, but when you start eating more bitterness, your palate changes. And I don't know if this is why you brought it up, Paul, but if you can learn to eat weeds and identify them in your gardens and not hate them or not be antagonistic, you know, against them, they are independents. You can grow these weeds let them grow in certain areas and understand that they are doing a job and that they are growing without any of your help, but they are a food source. They are a medicine. And let's just say this, even if you didn't keep them, but you understood them and you started to understand their role that they play in your garden, in the forest, in the landscape, this is independence, because it goes back to the beginning that the forest is independent of you or us. And those weeds are also. Sometimes you may think the weeds are out to get you, but they are there and they have so many different functions. And we touched on this when we were talking in the last show about soil fertility and about how what weeds can show you is what's deficient in your soil, how they can harvest minerals. But I think more importantly here is that idea of independence and that seeking that independence. And one of the, I think we're getting, this is getting great here.
It's awesome. We need to talk back for the next 5 hours. But
basically, because now we're looking at these natural systems. Now we're looking at them without judgment. Let's remove the judgment and let's think about how the judgment of good and bad. Let's just think about the judgments of functionality and what function is each element what, you know, even if you wanted to get a piece of paper out and get into it and go, ah, okay, dandelion weed, and you look up dandelion weed on the computer, the plant dandelion, and or in a book or something, and now you see all the attributes of this most hated weed. And you go, oh my gosh. I mean, in some health food stores, they sell dandelion greens. I grow some. Now, they're looking at that stuff like that, changing the way your mind, you're starting to move into a lifestyle of independence, where you looking at different things now, whatever they may be, and instead of good or bad, we start to look at functionality, and we start to go, wait a second, whoa, how can that work in our lives, importantly in our gardens, that's what we're talking about today. What are those plants doing? What can they do? If I don't rake all those leaves up, if I don't take all the branches off my house, mainly if I don't rake up all those leaves and I just leave them on the dirt, maybe you could blow them off your driveway or whatever, you know, off the hardscape areas. But if I leave them in the dirt, they do what the forest does to create its independence. And when you start mimicking those things and understanding those functions, you start to save money, save water. You do suppress weeds with leaves because the weeds don't want to grow anymore because there's enough fertility in the soil. They don't really have a big reason to grow anymore. You're changing the dynamics of the soil by leaving that leaf litter on the ground from all these plants, and all the way back to those nitrogen-fixing plants drop a lot of leaves. So you start, now your functions of these different elements of what they do, their attributes, start going sky high, and the more they have, the more independence you're creating in your system. So
absolutely. And you kind of mentioned something that I wanted to bring up, is that you mentioned that the weeds might be a little bitter, some of them. And, well, in our Western diet, we become accustomed to sweetness. Everything we eat is sweet. We're very salty. And that is by design. In the stores make salty food because they want to sell you beer, or they want to sell you soda, and they make sweet food because once you start eating it, you want more and more. It's very hard to break that carbohydrate cycle. Whereas when you're eating natural food that's not processed, you're actually don't become addicted like you do to these processed foods in the stores. So it's really what you're eating in the stores is designed to make you buy more. And in nature, you can only eat so many weeds, and then you go on to the next thing, or so many pieces of fruit. And, you know, it's a slower pace, a far more healthier pace. And, again, weeds are free. And the other thing is, what's hilarious, and I know there are many people out there listening who actually go to their health food store or even their name brand store these days, and they'll buy milk thistle in the vitamin section, or they'll buy saw palmetto for the, you know, all the male prostate cancer. And, you know, there's all these different herbal remedies that people are actually paying for when you probably have the exact same weed in your garden. Now, we're not telling you to just go out and start eating weeds. No, you must identify and make sure you know what you're eating. And if you are going to, test them, see how you react to them, because, you know, you might not have a favorable reaction. But it is a way for you. We need to get back to a natural form of living where we can just make use of everything that we have around us. And if we need extra, sure, there's no problem in going to the store or, you know, bartering with a neighbor or buying from someone who's growing locally if you can't do it yourself. But the very fact that we're paying for stuff that you can get for free, to me, is just hilarious.
Well, it gets pretty funny at times, but something when you were talking, I was thinking about, I was trying to think about you know, the work that it takes to put in these systems, if you're going to do them yourself. And, you know, it is laborsome, does take, you know, practice, and you do fail. You know, you have your happy little accidents, sad little failures, you know, things happen, especially when you're learning, and you keep going and keep going. But, and I was thinking, oh, physically, okay, you know, physically, I was thinking, oh, the garden and the plants and the different attributes and everything. And I was thinking, okay, doing physically. And when I keep thinking about independence, I think what we're looking at a lot now, especially for the, as our culture is transitioning into wanting more independence, wanting to not be so dependent on all these crazy systems that are set up. You know, whether we're going to solar panels because we're thinking, oh, well, we can be a little bit independent of this crazy grid of electrical systems. You know, we can produce our own power or different things like that. Or sometimes we're conscious of how, you know, the fuel of our vehicles and how you have an electric car or you're saving. You may be saving money or you may be thinking about the environment, but your mind is changing and our minds, our culture is changing. And when we're Even before we're talking about these physical actions and whether it's laborsome or it's expensive to get the electric car or the solar panels or whatnot, it's this consciousness. It's this mind of this consciousness of independence, like evoking that hope of independence and bringing it to the conscious mind. And through looking at the different things, whether you physically plant a tree, just the beginning of the process of looking at the tree or the plant or the car or the solar panels or the drive to work or the ride the bike to work or the train to work, you start to think patterning and understanding the different potentials of all these different avenues. And when you start to think about that instead of the previous kind of culture that I grew up in, or I feel like I grew up in, where, okay, I'm on my video game or I'm watching TV or I'm at school just getting this education that the book is saying or those types of things, I know and I feel innately that all of us as humans, we seek this independence. We feel it. And we can be a little scary. And then it almost sounds like sometimes we got to go do. Well, you have to put in in what we're talking about today with our little farm here and stuff. Oh, you got to put these systems in to have the independence. I think most importantly for this day and the day of independence was if you're talking about 4th of July and the history of our country, you're talking about the idea and the dream of becoming independent of that monarchy, of that control, of that system, and what that meant to the people and to our forefathers in this country. And now that we have our freedom, now what do? Now we have the freedom to go deeper and to change our consciousness and to look at these all the different things that are going on around us and start to take an account of what are they doing, and start to create our own personal Independence Day and to create our own revolution in our minds and the way we look at everything that's in front of our eyes. Whether it's the television and the show you're watching, what is that show doing for me personally and for the world? Or what is this plant doing for me and for the world? And how does that plant relate? How does this TV show relate? How does that car relate? And you take a baby steps, and you just work your way. It doesn't all have to be done now. But the more we all take those things and come, because we don't have a war to fight. It's internal now. You know, the only real problem we have now is kind of a culture that's set up where we can be very lazy if we choose to. And it's like this, it's like that monarchy that wants to control us. And that being said, I mean, I'm getting a little into it right now because it means a lot to me that we all enjoy a happiness that comes from independence and from trying to really understand what's going on around us in a very happy way, in a very loving way.
Well, and for me, when I hear that, you know, I just think of, well, what can I do? You know, what was I doing before, which was nothing? And then I took one step and I said, okay, I'm going to try to grow tomato plants. And I'm sorry, everyone, because every episode I'm probably going to talk about those darn tomato plants.
But they're good. We have a whole box of them you grew. Everybody devours them.
That's what I was just going to say. So
talk about them.
You know, Joey's talking about doing something that'll make you happy, or, you know, giving you a sense of like you're contributing. And I tell this every single time, but I don't even like tomatoes, but I grow them because I can, and I have 100% confidence that I can do it, and it brings me utter joy. It's a beautiful thing that I can do. And so yesterday I came over, and I literally had the guys hold, I'm like, what is this, like 25 pounds? 25 pounds of tomatoes, and there's so many people here. I can grow more than everyone needs. And that was this week. And I had some twice last week and week before that, over and over and over again, you can grow. And in the chat room, we have Sock Dude who's asked a question. Can permaculture methods be applied to gardening in a small space, such as a 10 by 20 foot patio? Sock Dude, my tomato area is literally, it's not even 1 foot. I mean, I think it's less than a foot wide, and it's a long strip. And I can bring 25 pounds of tomatoes to my friends twice a week. So, yes, you can absolutely do it. Now, there's something called monoculture, and it's really, you want to have a diversity. So when I grow so many tomatoes, that's really not ideal, because you like to have other things as well. But and I'll let Joey address the permaculture aspect of growing in a 10 by 20 space. But even from my little teeny strip, I mean, Joey, how much footage would you say that is? I only have I don't even know.
Probably 1 by 30.
I don't even think it's that long, but it's pretty darn small. And with that, just that little space, I also grow green, you know, different types of peppers. I could literally start a business. I mean, we're talking about independence here. I could sell these 100% non-spray. They're not certified organic because there's no reason for me to pay to do that. I know where those tomatoes have been. I haven't done anything to them. Mother Nature took care of them, and I could literally sell them if I wanted and start a business. And that's one of the elements of permaculture, which people don't always talk about, but it is definitely an element where there is an abundance, and we can share, whether you want to donate it to a charity or you want to barter with a neighbor or you actually want to make money doing this stuff, there is a way to do it, and that is independence. So let's get back to the question from Sock Dude. He obviously likes socks, but he wants to know, when he's wearing his socks, can he apply permaculture to a 10 by 20 foot patio, and how would he go about doing that?
Well, if we're going to say 10 by 20 patio, and we're going to say that patio's, I'm just going to say it's all cement.
Yeah.
And what's that, 200 square feet? So the application of permaculture design to that area would be where we're going to say there's going to be raised beds involved, some type of beds, and it can be just beds. It can be applied, because what you're going to be doing in there is you're going to look at first water. Are we going to water this garden with the hose, or are we going to water this garden because you catch water from one of your sinks? Or you take water from your bathtub, you let it fill up, and you pump the water out of the bathtub through a garden hose out to the garden and water it. So first we're looking at water. How are you going to water it? Now, permaculturally, it would be ideal is to use for the garden some source of water within in your apartment or your condo, wherever you're living. Use some water that's already been used to water the garden. Let's say you can't do that because it's the way you're renting. You just can't touch that, and you don't want to damage something or potentially damage something inside. So we're just going to water with the hose. Now we've decided we're going to water with the hose. Well, now you're going to ideally water with the hose or water with an irrigation system that uses, you know, a nice little amount of water. So that we're looking at that permaculturally with just being conscious of the water as an element and how we're going to water what we're going to, before we put anything, how are we going to water it? What are our options? Can we catch any rain? Because we could water a little bit with the rain, depending on how much you can catch off in a certain area of the roof, depending how it is. So we've kind of looked at that. And this is, you're designing permaculture. Let's start this off, because now when you're just thinking about these different things and you're starting to a process of thought before you get entangled in a lot of actual labor, this is part of permaculture, is this design and the way you're thinking about things. Because when we're talking about permaculture that way, now you're going to think, next thing I'd like to think about here is, where's the sun move over this backyard patio area? So you're going to think about that. And that is permaculture.
Well, can I also say one thing?
Yeah.
Permaculture is not just about food. It's also about energy conservation, water conservation. Each one of these are elements of permaculture. So when we're designing this patio and this system, which we want to include food, when he's talking about this flow of the sun, where is the path of the sun? I mean, if you want to talk about that little patio at your main house and how the trees, how that fits in, I think that's a good example as well. You know, like in the winter, the tree that is over this one area, there are no leaves on it. So the sun comes in and it warms the house. And then in the summer, it's completely covered with leaves and it cools the house. So that's one more element where we're actually saving energy and not having to pay. We have a little bit more independence there. Go ahead, Julie.
That's right. And so when you start thinking about energy and you start thinking about how what you're going to build your garden beds out of, if granted it's all cement. So are we going to use, you're going to go try to find reclaimed lumber, you know, lumber that's already been used, or are you going to buy the lumber, which is fine also. You're going to, but the process is that you're going to think about it. And then, like I was talking about nitrogen fixing plants, it can totally apply to your backyard, to your little patio in your garden beds, because you can plant a lot of different little plants, peas and beans. They fix nitrogen. They're an annual plant, but you could grow them, which is nice about small spaces, is you can grow them in your garden beds and have them go vertically on some different mesh material to grow up vertically. And now you have a wall, but all their roots are actually fixing nitrogen in there, and you can do what is called a cover crop. And so that we can look at that as a permacultural technique, because now you're putting the nitrogen in that soil that maybe later you're going to put your zucchini in that area. And there's nitrogen locked up in there now for your zucchini. You're going to be looking at a small earthworm bin on your patio to put your kitchen scraps in, or whatever different things that are from the garden. Maybe some little mouse got in there and ate something. And you can put that in there, into your worm bin. And now with your worm bin, if you have time to listen to our soils, kind of soil fertility show, we talked about these different aspects where you can do a little earthworm bin and start to regenerate some earthworm castings, and those can go into your garden. So, and that's an independent type of thing, and we're looking at it to see which things we can implement in there. And how you build your garden beds, depending on where the sun is at, and what you plant in those garden beds. Is one area just always shady? And does it get hot in your area? Well, that would be a nice lettuce area. When you start thinking that way, you're thinking permaculturally. Because now your garden area is going to be more permanent in that way. Because now you're going, wait a second, I don't got to go buy so much nitrogen, because I'm going to grow some of it and fix it into the soil over here. I'm going to capture a little rainwater over here, so now I have a little more independence there. I'm going to actually going to get some water under my bathtub or something like that, so I have a little more water independence, or I'm utilizing that energy a lot better. The worm bin is going, I'm producing those very valuable. You go look and see how much a bag of earthworm castings cost. You're producing the highest grade earthworm castings when you're doing it like this at your home. So they blow the ones away that you would buy by producing at your house. Another phase of independence right there. Just whatever you're going to grow, now you start looking up companion planting. You grow a little bit of flowers. Those different flowers, the roots resist certain bugs in the soil, and they help other plants grow. And you start looking at those different kind of situations, and they start stacking, is what we call it in our little world here. We start stacking the functions, flowering plants, vegetable plants, flowering plants attract insects. So yes, the answer to your question is you can totally apply permaculture
totally
to your backyard area. It's the process. It's the design. It's the starting the thinking about it, and it's trial and error. You know, that's what it, and you keep putting it in. You build a garden bed. You try to figure out, there's a lot of different designs that give you what you're looking at, especially in the small spaces, how you can get the maximum amount of plantable area with the least amount of path space, but where you can access and touch everything. And that's usually, it's usually a keyhole design in small spaces. So you're going to start looking at the different garden designs, and you're going to start looking up things like square foot gardening, which is a full intensive method. It's totally doable.
Totally.
You can do it there, and it's sometimes it's easier to do there because you can look out using your kitchen window, your sliding glass door, and you can watch everything that's happening.
Well, and another thing I'd like to say is that while permaculture is a modern science, meaning it's a design science where we could use technology, we can use, you know, chemistry and different things to understand why we build the systems. But, you know, a lot of this was around for millions of years. Like when, speaking of independence, when, you know, the first settlers came to the Americas and they didn't see any farming. But it's because the Native Americans were farming in ways that were completely different than what they were used to. And they used something called the Three Sisters, which is traditionally corn, squash, and beans, which is 100% permaculture. I mean, you have the corn stalk or sunflowers, which grow straight up in the air, and they reach for the sky and for the sun. And then you have the beans, which are the nitrogen fixtures that grow up the pole of the stalk because they need to be supported. And then underneath you have the squash, which is a form of water harvesting and water preservation because it shades the soil and keeps it cool under the heat of the sun. And all three live symbiotically, and it's just an incredible thing. And like sunflowers, which are not, that's an alternate method of the Three Sisters, they have an extremely high fat content. So it's a high calorie nutrient food, as well as the beans, you know, have good proteins. And, you know, it's nothing new, really. It's just we've lost it. We're removed from it. So we don't think the way that we used to. If we could just listen and look at our histories and learn from our other cultures who are still close to the earth, I think we could really learn a lot and really gain the independence. Like when the first settlers came here and that first winter at Thanksgiving, what had to happen? The Native Americans, who they saw as, you know, simpleton, you know, like a different way of life, they were feeding them throughout the winter because they knew how to live close to the earth, and the Europeans did not.
Well,
right?
Yeah, you're right. And our original farmers here, there wasn't, you know, chemical fertilizers.
Right.
They used a lot of cover crops to fix, and that was that relationship that fixed that nitrogen in the soil. So they'd grow a whole bunch of cover crop that fixed the nitrogen. Then they'd plow it in, cut it down and plow it in, and then there would just be massive amounts of nitrogen. And then they'd plant whatever other crop they were going to plant over there, which was normally wheat. But they would plant and, you know, another crop over that, and they would, all those types of situations would continue.
And I think a lot of them were nomadic, so they would use an area for a while and they'd leave so the systems could rebuild themselves, nature could rebuild itself, and they'd go and follow the seasons as well, which, you know, we can't really do now, but you can definitely use the time, you know, the seasons to our advantage, you know.
Yeah, you can be conscious of them is what we're talking about, being conscious of all these different elements and then being conscious of the ideas that you can start. Yes, we don't live like they lived. We're not going to live like they lived. We're not going to do that anymore. But so what we have now is the world's plant species at our fingertips, basically. We can take plants from all over the world now and put them into systems. So what we can design when we're conscious of all the different attributes and elements and energies is just amazing. The potential there is infinite. And the level of independence that can be reached totally will rival and could surpass what nature does in its slow, slow, very passive, very hardy approach. We can take those plants and put them into systems and accelerate all the different patterns that are going on in nature. We can accelerate those and we can work with them and bring in species of plants from all over the world and increase the diversity. And we're talking about doing it on areas that we've disrupted or really ruined. I'm not talking about going out into these native zones and like tearing it down or putting in all these different species within those zones. I'm talking about all the massive areas that we've tore apart with our machines and stuff like that. That's what I'm talking about, regenerating those and even working them into those small garden spaces, however tight they are. You're still working the same elements in, the same ideas. You're trying to understand the same approach to get that level of independence going. And then permaculture is by far a supreme methodology to attain it. It covers plant, like Paul said, it covers plants, energy. The design science of permaculture designs our communities. The way we live, the houses we live in, we can design it from a standpoint of looking at it permaculturally. And we're talking about a culture, a permanent culture, not one that vacillates or gets all hot and bothered about the newest thing that's out there. It's one that bases it in the ecology of nature. And that's what's great about it. And that's what can be so independent.
And one thing I really like is that although we're building a dependence and all that, as far as the culture goes, within permaculture, the people that I've met have been so generous with their knowledge, with their extra time and energy. And, you know, it's really incredible to see how the community is building, and it's like the greed is out of it. Like everyone is just so willing to share and to, you know, to learn and to contribute. Whereas, you know, normally you have to pay for someone to come to your yard and work in your garden. And I've found over and over again that people are willing to share, like, you know, they want to learn. How do we do this? So they come and they volunteer to help. And then it's just like a circle. It's really neat. And I love that aspect, the people aspect of it. So, Joey, we have 6 minutes. And I don't know if everyone heard that, but I think I heard a firecracker or something in the background.
Yeah, my friend came over because we're doing a little fun stuff tonight. But we shot off a couple. My friend came over with some crazy firework and shot them off the other day, and our neighbors got mad. It was like shot up in the sky and made one of those big, you know, things in the sky. And
wow.
And that was a little too much for our neighbors. And now it sounds like he's toned it down, but that means firecrackers.
Uh-huh.
Which I think my wife will go take care of that.
How funny.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. He's like a big kid.
Well, he's independent, wants to do what he wants. So.
Yeah, when he gets out here to Tijuana Farm, he's all, oh, well, it's, you know, we can just do whatever we want.
Yeah. Well, I really love today's topic. And again, each time we talk, I mean, there's within each of the things that we mentioned, you could literally have not one episode, but five episodes about each topic. And there's something called a PDC or Permaculture Design Certification courses, which you can find hopefully in your own community. Joey is a certified specialist and he teaches classes. And why don't you tell us a little bit about how those classes work and, you know.
How a PDC works?
Yeah. Tell us about them.
Well, there's a